ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello again, Robin Williams with another of our summer specials, which this time has been a series of remarkable scientific women. Émilie du Châtelet in France, Dr. Rena Fu in Perth, Mary Somerville from Scotland, all with the most unlikely educational histories. And this week, a woman who had practically no schooling at all, yet she ended up helping the then Prince Charles with both botany and entomology, flowers and butterflies. Who possibly could this be? Back in 1993, I was keen for you to meet one of the smartest, most flamboyant and wealthy scientists ever. She shared my taste in clothes. Two sets only, one for summer and one for winter, and both should take no more than 45 seconds to put on. This fellow of the Royal Society of London, holder of umpteen honorary degrees, hadn't been to school, let alone university, and was the world authority on fleas. She also knew lots about butterflies and so was consulted by Prince Charles to see how he could get them together at one of his estates, and they became friends. This had to be a science show, and she was getting on. But what about interviewing Charles as well? Sharon Carleton was keen. Our problem was that Charles was saying no to everything because of the Diana uproar, and the ABC had, of course, no money. So what to do? Bill Hayden, then Governor General, was a personal friend and used to phone me regularly for advice about science books to read. So I asked him, would he contact the palace and ask for the interview? And the answer came back, yes. Anything for Miriam Rothschild and science. Which left the problem of the fare to London. Worry not, said Sharon. I'll use Richard's frequent flyer points. And so it happened. Here is a little present. To you, to me, and all those fleas.
You know, we've managed since the last war to destroy vast, vast areas of this country in terms of its flora and fauna. And all the sort of herb-rich meadows and the chalk downland and the wetlands and all these things. And we have actually reduced these areas to very, very small little patches here and there. And I feel very strongly about trying to make my own tiny little contribution to trying to find ways of restoring some of these habitats.
And where does a royal personage like the Prince of Wales go to get advice on conservation matters? Why, to the very best. And when it comes to wildflower habitats, that's to Dr. Miriam Rothschild. But it's not only wildflowers that this extraordinary 85-year-old woman scientist knows about. She also has a vast knowledge of butterflies and fleas, birds, fish and poisons, marijuana, ladybirds and sheepdogs, farming, Clark Gable and the flowers of Israel. She designs her own clothes, has an art gallery devoted to the paintings by schizophrenics, owns a pub and is one of the Rothschilds. Welcome to today's Science Show special on Dr. Miriam Louisa Rothschild.
Oh, Lord Rothschild. Coming! I'm coming! Are you all right, my lord?
Quite all right now, Woods. I only lost my centre of gravity in the bath.
Very good, my lord. I'll look for it later.
The Rothschilds are different from the rest of us. The English author Samuel Butler asserted a century ago that the Rothschilds are the most astonishing organisms the world has ever seen. And the Honourable Dr. Miriam Louisa Rothschild, Commander of the Order of the British Empire, Fellow of the Royal Society, and recipient of 6 honorary Doctor of Science degrees, is a Rothschild through and through.
Well, in my case, of course, I was fantastically lucky because I was born into the branch of the family that were really interested in natural history and science. And I had the wonderful advantage of having been of independent means, of being able to follow this hobby of mine, which really meant everything to me.
Since old Meyer Amschel founded the dynasty in the Jewish ghetto of Frankfurt in the mid-1700s, generation after generation of Rothschild has layered spectacular business success upon spectacular personal wealth, until the Rothschilds' power and money surpassed that of some of the crowned heads of Europe. The first real Rothschild eccentric started to appear in the English branch of the House of Rothschild, perhaps inevitably. Who but a Rothschild would drive a carriage through Piccadilly, pulled by four zebras, or go up to Cambridge as a student, accompanied by a flock of kiwis? Actually, the Rothschild who did these things was Miriam's uncle Walter. She shares with him an intense love of the natural world, and the fact that neither ever went to school.
I was educated at home. My father hated schools, and he hated public examinations, with the result that I never took any, and I was really completely uneducated. But at home, natural history and science was part of everyday life. It wasn't a subject. We just lived it. And the first thing I can remember is having a bird as a pet and having white mice to look after, and grew up as a naturalist from the word go.
I dreamt, and in my dream I was a butterfly. I woke, or is it simply that, weary of the sky, some butterfly is sleeping and dreams that it is I?
In the citation for an honorary degree from Oxford in 1968, Miriam Rothschild was commended for her contributions to anatomy, chemistry, entomology, pharmacology, neurophysiology and zoology. Not bad for someone without formal training. Dr. Rothschild is also unusual in that she's a prolific letter writer.
Oh, well, yes, of course, everybody laughs about my letter writing, and they say I'm like someone on a motor bicycle motoring across country and spraying letters right and left wherever I go.
She's written every day for 35 years to her cousin, Alex de Rothschild, of the French banking house, some 13,000 letters in all. Dr. Rothschild has also been writing to two Australian scientists, John and Faith Evans, not every day, but spasmodically over the past 25 years. I'm using extracts from these letters and a selection of poetry from Dr. Rothschild's book, Butterfly Cooing Like a Dove, to help fill in the many gaps in the public persona of Miriam Louisa.
October 1967. Dear John and Faith, I have had a most interesting year's work, a little too full as usual, and have just come back from Israel. With great regret, I have cancelled the paper I was reading at the Moscow Congress, as I feel it's quite impossible for me to visit that country while their attitude both towards Israel and their own Jewish population is so outrageous. No Jew at this moment could go voluntarily to Russia. The most tiresome thing about my work is the shortage of rabbit fleas in this country at the moment. With best wishes, Miriam.
Not only is the name of Rothschild associated with banking and science, it also stands for the leadership of the Jewish diaspora. The famous Balfour Declaration of 1917, which committed the British government to a Jewish homeland, was in the form of a letter. The letter started, "Dear Lord Rothschild," and was addressed to Miriam's uncle Walter. He's the greatest single collector of natural history specimens ever. In his museum at Tring, which is just northwest of London, he had 2.25 million butterflies and moths alone.
I, who am I? I live as a fugitive, singer of flowers, songs I make, and butterflies of song. They bloom in my soul so that my heart may taste them.
November 72. Dear John and Faith, I am now just beginning to recover from the delights of my trip to Australia. The fleas that I managed to round up there have settled down well on the hamsters and are doing fine. I managed to muscle in on a collecting trip to the highlands of New Guinea and had a promise of 50 species of fleas not represented in the Rothschild collection at the British Museum. And, as you know, we have about 95% of known fleas. Freeman, their entomologist, said it was not worthwhile contributing any money to the expedition. I really think that the pressures of everyday life in the UK make for this type of attitude, and it's one which I find extremely irritating. Love, Miriam.
No question, she was very unusual. You know, directness of statement and obviously not only a scintillating intelligence, but a scintillating wit.
Dr. Derek Denton, the founding director of the Florey Institute and one of Dr. Rothschild's many Australian colleagues.
She knows I have a character defect, or one of many, but involves a fondness of wine. We were just eating together, so she went down to the cellar and brought something up, and it was a 1945 Lafite, which is really one of the great years of the century. So we opened it, and Miriam doesn't drink really much, but she prepared to taste it. And it was pure vinegar. So it was a disaster. So she went down to the cellar and got a 1947 Chateau Lafite. So we opened that, tasted it, pure vinegar, mega disaster. So she went down, got something out of the 60s, because she has a thing every year. And happily to report, that was good. But very good. What really emerged from this, she'd had a big storm there, and the water had gone into the cellar and been pumped out relatively quickly. But it obviously got at the older bottles, and she had suffered a terrible setback.
How did she react to it?
Sort of philosophically.
Miriam Rothschild's career outside the home began in the late 1920s. She first did some research work in Naples on certain marine worms that live in the kidneys of seabirds. But it was some years later, as a student researcher at the Marine Biological Station in Plymouth in the south of England, that she made the first of her startling discoveries.
I was examining some snails there, and I came across these parasites of the snails. And they were tiny little transparent creatures swimming in the water like eagles, really, they looked, as if they were birds swimming. And they were so marvellous, and I was so enthralled with them. And the master of the expedition, the professor or whoever he was really a schoolmaster, but he said to me, well, I take one look at those things. I've never seen those before, and I think they're a new species. And I was completely hooked. The life cycles of these worms were so extraordinary. Only a humorous god could have invented these life cycles. They couldn't possibly have been the result of evolution. There was one worm which I was particularly interested in. It started its life in the water as an egg. It then turned into a sort of swimming little thing that looked like a bumblebee swimming in the water. And it then penetrated a snail, went in as one, and then it split up into hundreds of little ones which came out in the water. And they were tailed, like transparent tadpoles with tails. And they withdrew into their own tails, if you can imagine anything so fantastic, and floated about in the water. And then, as the tiny little shrimp came along, a crustacea, was fascinated by these things swimming in the water and began to try and eat them. And then the little worm shot itself out of its tail like a catapult into the swimming little crab, or whatever you like to call shrimp, and into its mouth and into the back of its body, where it began to develop as a worm. And then it was eaten by a dragonfly, and subsequently by a frog who ate the dragonfly, and it finished up as a worm living under the tongue of a frog. And that, to me, was so extraordinary and so amazing that I thought, the rest of my career, I'm going to study these worms. And it really was for the next 5 or 6... Well, until the war broke out, I was a student of parasitic worms.
In November 1939, a German bomb completely destroyed 7 years' hard labour. Miriam Rothschild's equipment, specimens, cultures, books and manuscripts, all gone. But true to character, Dr. Rothschild changed disaster into opportunity. She returned home to her birthplace, Ashton Wold in Northamptonshire, to study farming and myxomatosis. Ashton Wold was built in 1900 on a truly baronial scale by Miriam's grandfather, Natty. He built it for his son and Miriam's father, Charles. During the war, Ashton Wold was taken over by the men of the US Air Force's 351st Squadron. Miriam Rothschild had turned the manor over to the Red Cross, and the wheat fields became an airstrip. Recognise this voice. It's one of the servicemen.
You know, I like people who stand up and fight back, especially if it happens to be a woman who looks extraordinarily beautiful when she's doing it, and even more beautiful when she's calmed down.
Clark Gable was a very strange person to suddenly find wandering around an Ashton Wold. But he was always, I mean, amazingly good-looking. He was always smiling and in frightfully good spirits. But I wouldn't say that he was a man with a tremendous sense of humour. It struck me that underneath all his outward laughter and charm, he was rather serious.
In 1943, Miriam Rothschild married a handsome Hungarian commando serving in the British Army. They raised a large family and, although they divorced 36 years ago, remained good friends. Marine biology was no longer practical with a demanding young family, so Dr. Rothschild concentrated on her study of myxomatosis. She discovered that in Britain, fleas were the main vectors or carriers of the myxomatosis virus. And after the children had been fed, watered and tucked up in bed, Miriam the scientist would lose herself in the miraculous revelations of her microscope.
One of the great advantages of fleas over these parasitic worms was that you could study them dead between two pieces of glass. You didn't have to have them alive. At that time, my fleas were all museum specimens. Actually, the first new species of fleas that I discovered were Australian fleas. But they were easier to study if you had to stay at home with the kids.
How happier is the flea which in thy breast doth play than that pied butterfly which courts the flame and in the same doth die.
A single cupboard in Dr. Rothschild's bedroom come workroom contains some 60,000 microscopic preparations of fleas, testimony to 50 years' sheer pleasure. She's the world's leading authority in this area. No wonder the French dubbed her Queen of the Fleas.
And we were all very curious to know how fleas jumped. And then we discovered that they had in their legs, rather in the joints above their legs, really. It was a rubber-like substance, rather like sorbo rubber, which when it was compressed and then suddenly released by this muscle relaxation, it shot the flea up into the air, where an acceleration was so enormous it developed an acceleration of 129 G, which is greater, 20 times greater, than that of a moon rocket re-entering the Earth's atmosphere. It was a very stupendous jump, but there was some snag about it. We didn't really know quite how this mechanism worked. And on this flight to Israel, we were going along in this airplane quite smoothly, and suddenly it gave a fearful lurch, like airplanes do. I thought, I know how that flea jumps. It's got a click mechanism, and as I had a lot of morphological study of the flea, I suddenly realised where this central peg was that slipped out of its socket and worked like what they call a click mechanism.
Dr. Rothschild has only recently completed a 35-year cataloguing project. It's based on her father's 30,000-strong flea collection, now in the British Museum. Even today, it still raises a smile, the idea of a leading banker collecting fleas. When Charles Rothschild started his collection back in the 1880s, a local wit claimed the most precious specimen had cost the owner £1,000. But on closer inspection, it turned out to have escaped from the family bank. Humour aside, the leading banker actually discovered the species of flea which carries the bubonic plague. His daughter made a fair few discoveries about the flea too.
Nobody could breed the fleas in the laboratory. Well, that's very funny, because generally you can't stop fleas breeding. I mean, that's the trouble. But here was a flea which refused to breed in the laboratory. So I began looking at this. And, you know, sometimes you have a hunch. Well, I spent my life debunking my own brilliant flashes of insight, but on this occasion it worked. I had the hunch that it was linked to the breeding of the rabbit. And therefore, I tried, first of all, just on a female rabbit, and that didn't work. And then, of course, on a pregnant rabbit. And then we found that once you got the fleas onto the pregnant rabbit, their life cycle was synchronized with the breeding cycle of the rabbit. And all the mammalian hormones controlled the development of the fleas' eggs.
Was this the first time that a parasite was known to depend on its host for breeding?
More or less, yes.
This animal's a pregnant female, and you can see the number of fleas that you can find, particularly at the base of the ears.
Dr. Michael Holland, a senior research scientist with the CSIRO's Division of Wildlife and Ecology, is one of a number of Australian scientists looking at new ways of controlling our rabbit population. His work is based both on fertility control and mortality.
Now, the first step is to find something that will provoke an immune response in the rabbits that will render them infertile. What we're looking at is components of the sperm surface and the surface of the egg that are normally involved in fertilisation. Rabbit sperm fertilise rabbit eggs and not eggs from other species, because they have specific components on the surface of the egg and on the sperm that interact. If we can identify these components, which are believed to be proteins, they can be used to provoke an immune response in the rabbit that will produce antibodies, which will bind to these proteins and block the physiological role of these proteins in fertilisation, and then produce a contraceptive effect. Now, the second part of the equation is, how would you ever spread that contraceptive effect into rabbit populations? And here's where our genetic engineering experience will come into play. What we're going to do is find the genes that code those proteins that I just mentioned before, cut that piece of rabbit DNA out, insert it into the myxomatosis virus itself. Then when the virus replicates in an animal, it will not only produce its own virus proteins, but it will produce these rabbit proteins as well. And essentially, the virus will act as a vaccine. Large numbers of rabbits will still die from the viral infection, but those rabbits which survive the infection will now be infertile. And they are the key part of the rabbit population, which is the current basis of the problem. Because normally, when they survive the myxoma infection, they would be immune to subsequent infections and so not be killed by the disease.
But, as we already know, thanks to Dr. Rothschild's work, the reproductive cycle of the European flea is tied to that of the pregnant rabbit. No reproducing rabbits, no reproducing fleas either. Scientists are now considering introducing a different flea, this time from Spain, to carry the genetically altered virus.
Yes, that's completely correct. The Spanish flea doesn't have its reproductive cycle tied to that of the rabbit. So its reproduction and spread would not be affected by the work that we are doing.
April 1974. Dear John and Faith, believe it or not, we still have three echinophaga I smuggled back from Canberra, feeding round the snout of a long-suffering hamster. Fleas are extraordinary beasts. Edith Evans, the registrar of the Entomological Society, is helping me with some of the research needed for my biography of my Uncle Walter. This is a difficult job, as when the British Museum took over at Tring, they burnt the photos on the walls which belonged to me. I will enjoy revealing all this in the said biography. At the time he died, I had typhoid fever, so to add to the chaos, his personal letters were destroyed too, without asking me, although I was his heir. Love and good works for 77, Miriam.
Tell me also, in this last letter of yours, you mentioned how you smuggled some fleas out of Canberra. I have visions of you with a suitcase with a secret bottom and files of fleas hidden in there. You didn't actually bring them out on your person, did you?
No, not at all. As far as I remember, they came out on a mouse. I brought the mouse out and the fleas on the mouse.
How did you get the mouse out?
They didn't seem to worry about mice and they didn't worry about stoats. I once travelled with a live stoat and they never bothered about that.
So why did you want these Australian fleas and what did you do with them?
Because we didn't have that species of Australian flea in England and I wanted to study it.
Do not decorate my grave with flowers or candles, because flowers may deceive the songbirds and the candle may burn the moth.
Miriam Rothschild was in her late 60s when, once again, she contrived to turn apparent disaster into opportunity. She'd had a bad bout of shingles of the eyes and could no longer peer lovingly down her microscope for hours on end. Fleas were just too small. So she turned her attention to dream flowers, childhood dreams which have broken loose from their stalks and escaped into the sunshine, air and angels. To most of us, they're butterflies.
The interesting thing was that these very brightly coloured butterflies, which were obviously disagreeable to the taste of birds, often fed on toxic plants. And it had long been thought by other scientists that they probably collected the caterpillars, sequestered the poisons from the plants and stored them in their bodies. But there was no proof of this. And so I decided that it would be a good idea to try and study this chemically. And I was terribly lucky in having a wonderful collaborator in Thaddeus Reichstein, who was a chemist who won the Nobel Prize for the discovery of cortisone. And we worked together on this, and we found this was true, that the butterflies could sequester toxins from their plants.
Did you also study the sex lives of the butterflies as you did the fleas?
Not in quite the same way, but I was very interested in the behaviour of some of the male butterflies, which I described, I think, in a popular article as chauvinistic pigs, because the monarch butterfly, instead of attracting the female with beautiful perfumes and wonderful displays, as some of their relatives do, just rape the females. They strike them down and rape them.
Well, so much for the sex lives of butterflies. Tell me, can the cabbage white butterfly really count?
Well, it can certainly assess its egg load. When it lays about 100 eggs on a plant, it goes off, says that's enough on that plant. It can assess the fact that if it laid any more eggs, the plant would be overloaded by its young, which were going to hatch. So it goes off and lays on another plant. Well, now, we were very interested to know how it did this. I mean, how did it count its egg? And we discovered, after laying the eggs, or during laying the eggs, it pours a chemical over them. And when the smell of this chemical gets strong enough, they know that's time to stop laying eggs. And other butterflies then come, smell this chemical, and they decide, no, we won't lay on that plant. So it preserves the plant for the caterpillars that are going to hatch. This chemical is very interesting, and they've been trying to find out what it is for a very long time, and finally discovered that it was a chemical that had never been found before in animals. And I'm told that they had to call it myriamide, which is rather a nice name for a chemical.
The butterfly counts not months, but moments, and has time enough.
October 1979. Dear John and Faith, I am bad at being 71. I feel there is still so much to do, and I'm no good at short-term organising. I have a feeling that all the conservation one has struggled over for so long will all be swept away just by default. Unfortunately, Alex, the cousin in France to whom I'm devoted, had a tumour develop in her spinal cord, and she's having a lot of residual pain following the operation, so I spend a lot of time in France with her. At Ashton, we're going ahead with a new ploy, growing wildflowers for seeds. Cowslips, primroses, wild violets and the like are just vanishing, and I'm producing seed mixtures and giving, or selling them, to the various conservation trusts. It is quite a challenge. I send my love, Miriam.
Miriam Rothschild has fought ferociously to make the British public aware of its wildflower heritage. It is perhaps the most obvious of her many public-spirited campaigns. She fought for the refugees from Nazi Germany, fought for free milk in schools, for the legalisation of homosexual activity between consenting adults. As Dr. Rothschild explains, they're rather frank at Oxford and called her the bugger's friend. She designed a glass-walled squash court, was the original user of a crash helmet for competitive skiing, campaigned for research into schizophrenia and for better treatment of farm and laboratory animals. She also played cricket for England under a pseudonym, which she still refuses to divulge. At 85, she's conducting scientific experiments and her public campaigns with as much gusto as I suspect she did half a century ago.
December 82. My dear John and Faith, I'm sorry to tell you my cousin in Paris died. This was expected, but it was a hard blow for me. I had nursed her for over a year, and I began to feel she would go on living for a good deal longer and somehow have a few good summer days. The CBE is a lot of nonsense, but it was nice of you to congratulate me. The award, which I really enjoyed, was being made an associate of the 351st Bomber Group of the American Air Force. Someone there must have noticed the CBE and exclaimed, "Christ, is that old Bond still with us?" December 85. My wildflower project has done too well almost and has become a sort of national industry. Most of my time is now spent on the question of recreating habitats for wildflowers and Lepidoptera. Fortunately, the Prince of Wales is keen, and my wildflower garden at his place has been worth £1 million of advertising. My love to you both. Miriam.
His Royal Highness the Prince of Wales has recently co-authored a book, Highgrove, Portrait of an Estate, in which he's warmly appreciative of the advice Miriam Rothschild has given him on introducing wildflowers to his estate. Prince Charles.
It is absolutely fascinating where she lives, and it's rather gloriously eccentric in some ways. And she has this quite large, rambling house, but absolutely covered in all sorts of climbing things, and everything is rather wonderfully unkempt, you know. But then she also has other areas there of meadows which she harvests for the seeds, you know, which she then puts into bags and sells.
To you?
At vast expense, I hasten to say. It's very lucrative. It can be a very lucrative business. But no, she sold them to me to start with, and then obviously to all sorts of other people.
So what happened when you went to see her and you said, I'd like wildflowers at Highgrove? What was her reaction?
Well, she was thrilled. I mean, I remember meeting her somewhere before that and talking to her and getting frightfully excited about the idea of establishing a wildflower patch or something. And so, of course, she was only too thrilled because she'd been writing about trying to establish wildflowers in many parts of the country, along the roadsides and things like that. The difficulty, of course, is to try and regenerate such places, because once you've actually ploughed them up and destroyed an ancient system of management, once you stop all that and you introduce a different system altogether, it takes a long, long time. It's like once you start destroying or cutting down ancient woodlands, you can't just recreate an ancient woodland. Takes hundreds of years. And this is what I think is so depressing about, you know, the attitudes of people. You know, it doesn't really matter, and you can recreate these things. You can't. It is a major operation. So that's another reason why I wanted to do it.
The first thing Dr. Rothschild did was to sow a hay meadow, which is right beside the house, with wildflowers, or weeds as some would have it. The seeds were drilled directly into the pasture. The display that spring should have been gorgeous. It wasn't. In fact, it was remarkably unimpressive. The grasses just proved too strong for the flowers. The next experiment at Highgrove went much more smoothly. Imagine, if you will, a substantial English 18th century country residence with a gravel drive half a kilometre or so long, leading to imposing black gates, meadows and horses, rare black Hebridean sheep with bells blowing in the wind. Instead of the expected manicured flower beds and neatly pruned shrubs along either side of the drive, the prince decided on wildflowers, lots of them and brilliantly coloured. To achieve this effect, Dr. Rothschild planted a special version of her wildflower seed mixture, roguishly called the Farmer's Nightmare. She combined wildflowers that grow on arable land with wildflowers which grow in hayfields.
The difficulty about that is the management, because although you may get a fantastic display the first year, which indeed I did, it looked wonderful, I couldn't believe it. It was a great joy for 2 months or so it lasted. But then, of course, you've got the difficulty of how do you get it back the next year? Because in our climate, in this country, it's so damp and wet, and the grasses invade rapidly and smother most of these arable wildflowers. And then you get docks of those awful weeds, you know, and you get thistles. And you've got to go around and pull them out by hand. So in the first year, I spent a great deal of time on Sunday mornings or something trying to pull up docks and
you mean you got your fingers dirty?
Of course I did, yes. I spent a great deal of time in my own garden. But of course everybody now comes to Highgrove and says, where are the wildflowers? You know? Right along the lines of Miriam Rothschild, who's been such a great pioneer of so many of these things over the years, and at a time when nobody wanted to know, she was still determinedly going on doing wonderful things, I think, and trying to save different species and habitats and so on. And I do think we need to rediscover some of the things we've lost and thrown away. And we've actually been busily chucking the baby out with the bathwater, I think, for the last 40 years or so. More, 50, 60 years. Treating everything as an industrial process, which I think is utterly wrong. And I do think that the important thing is to try and rediscover that long-term view and vision which our ancestors tended to have. And without that, I think we will end up in a very awkward position eventually. And people may turn around and say, well, it's all right for him. But I mean, whatever they say, I'm still determined to try and do what I think is the right thing.
November 1986. Dear John and Faith, I have a strong feeling you wouldn't find my present ploy very exciting. The pursuit of insect scents, which we can smell. I assume they're for anti-vertebrate predators. Especially pyrazines, which suddenly appear all over the place. I send my love, Miriam.
Mm. wrong, Miriam Rothschild. Your work on pyrazines, those highly scented chemicals which enhance animals' capacity to remember, is exciting and far too important to brush over in a paragraph or two. Once more, it was a Miriam Rothschild insight, hunch if you like, that would take conventional science another 20 years to prove. And the identification of these amazing pyrazines was actually made in Canberra by one of Dr. Rothschild's Australian colleagues, the CSIRO's Professor Barry Moore.
Well, I guess it goes back to the early 60s, really, when Miriam wrote a paper drawing attention to a well-known fact that poisonous insects and plants had rather similar odours. And she then went on to make the novel suggestion that this could be a manifestation of chemical mimicry, that this could be regarded as mimicry going on at the like rather than in the visual form. 20 years later, we were very involved in looking into chemical defence in insects generally, and we were very interested in particular in a mimetic ring that's well known in Australia involving all sorts of other insects that mimic them. And they happen to have this very same odour that we've been talking about. Long story short, we identified not only their toxins, but we identified the odour as being based on these pyrazines, you see.
How did you tell Miriam Rothschild, how did she find out that something her nose might have sniffed at 20 years before had been identified?
Well, I guess our paths really crossed at a conference in Paris about 12 years ago. This was an symposium on mimicry. And I was billed there to detail our findings on these mysterious warning odours, you see. And, of course, the moment Miriam learned from my lecture that we'd identified them as opened a sort of Pandora's box, if you like, of all sorts of research possibilities.
If Dr. Rothschild's postulation on odour mimicry had been novel, then her next hunch was even more so. Most of us would have experienced one of those instant, crystal-clear flashbacks to childhood when a particular smell has triggered our memory. Now, did that odour contain pyrazines? And can these chemicals actually enhance our memory? Dr. Rothschild suggested it was so.
First of all, we tried material on chicks, of course, because birds are the chief predators of these insects and mimics. And we were able to show with collaborators in England that hatchling chicks soon learned to avoid water that had been made bitter with a small amount of quinine if we added pyrazines as a sort of odour signal. And indeed, they soon got to the stage where they would avoid odour with pyrazines even if the quinine wasn't present.
What was Dr. Rothschild's reaction to these chick experiments?
Oh, she was delighted and so was I. And then we decided, well, of course, birds are bird-brained, and so why don't we try some more intelligent animals? And we elected to transfer our attention to laboratory rats. And we were soon able to show that not only did the rats learn much quicker than the chicks, but the presence of pyrazine sort of increased their aptitude for learning in many different directions. They could perform better in mazes and all sorts of things like that.
January 1988. Dear John and Faith, 1988, ye gods. I hope your health is holding up. I take 16 pills a day but survive pottering. I asked my doctor if he thought it likely I would have a heart attack, and he said, very likely, which sounds reasonable for anyone of 81 who has high cholesterol and high blood pressure. But since I've existed on beta blockers for 15 years, I remain hopeful. Christmas Day, 1989. I am playing about with wildflower promotion, a bit of propaganda on television, a book trying to combine poetry, painting and natural history, a film with David Attenborough, a few vague experiments with quails and pyrazines, but really doddering along, falling over, and rather surprised and glad to still be around. I can occasionally look down the microscope, but pay heavily for it afterwards with a smashing headache. What I've been trying to look at is the arrangement of sperm within the spermatheca of fleas. This knowledge will have no effect on man's destiny, but it intrigues me personally.
I am confident no one else alive today knows how sperm are arranged in a flea spermatheca, or cares. And this idea appeals to my perverted sense of discovery. My love to you both, Miriam.
Sir David Attenborough, as one naturalist about another, one professional, if you like, about another, how is Miriam Rothschild regarded in the trade, so to speak?
Oh, with awe. Awe. Yes, she is an extraordinary person. And when she comes to a meeting or something which I'm involved, you listen very carefully to what she says. She's a very, I hope she won't mind me saying so, but she's very formidable. And she doesn't suffer fools gladly.
And when you first meet Miriam Rothschild, it's obvious this is no ordinary old lady. Even at 85, she's still a beautiful woman. She's energetic and sharp as a razor. As a journalist, one has the distinct feeling that your research better be good, because there'll be no getting away with any sloppy imprecisions. She has no time for trivialities, and that includes worrying about what she looks like. She designed her own clothes 40 years ago. Comfortable dress, matching jacket, and she has them made up in a range of colours. It takes her 2 minutes to dress, and that's it.
She favours gumboots. I mean, rubber boots. She does. She thinks they're sensible, and she's inclined to, therefore, to wear them at most times, just in case you happen to come across a puddle on a muddy field or something in the middle of Piccadilly. And so if you go for lunch with Miriam, she is inclined to turn up in a very smart West End restaurant wearing gumboots. And that's because she thinks clearly and logically and is not inclined to fuss with silly, empty convention. She has no wish to become a big public figure, and she does good by stealth. I mean, occasionally she gets cross and thinks that somebody in the conservation movement is not pulling their weight or doing their stuff or behaving foolishly or all those things. And then smoke arises above Ashton Wold and quite a lot of people's knees knock together.
Boxing Day, the Weizmann Institute, Israel, 1989. Dear John and Faith, I escaped from Christmas and came to Israel to reorganize a craft center here and do some feeble feeding experiments with jackdaws and a pyrazine insect secretion. One of my problems is a lack of elasticity in leg muscles, so that I fall about like a child of three. One picks up one's feet with the same effort, but it doesn't work, and you catch your toe on something and bang, have you broken your leg? No. Good. On we go. My daughter's horrified. Do be your age, Mum, or be careful. She doesn't understand the problem. I send you both every good wish, Miriam.
Well, I think old age is the most frightful bore, because there's so many things that you wanted to do that you can't do anymore. But there's another side, of course, to life, and that is that if you're a naturalist, it's always interesting and life can never be long enough.
What do you think has given you the most enjoyment out of your life?
Oh, that's easy to answer. That's my family, my children. I love having a family.
Over the dianthus. See? A white butterfly. Whose soul, I wonder?
August 26th, 1990. My dear Faith, I was very sad to read your news of John's leaving the scene. It was not a shock, as his last letter was obviously that of a very sick, very tired man. Something has happened to me this year. I feel tired for the first time in 82 years. I'm the last of my siblings, as both my sisters and my brother died since I last wrote, and also all my greatest friends have hurried off to heaven ahead of me. So one begins to feel discouraged. I send you all my sympathy and much love, Miriam.
Widow Faith Evans, one of the two scientists Miriam wrote to for all those years, and who kindly let us share in that correspondence.
Well, she was a wonderful friend. My husband thought Miriam was quite the most vivid and attractive woman he's ever met, as well as the most intelligent. And I suppose in many ways I was very glad he didn't meet her back in the 30s when we were married. But it's been a wonderful friendship. People like Miriam are very, very rare.
I was talking to a moth the other evening. He was trying to break into an electric light bulb and fry himself in the wires. It is better to be happy for a moment and be burned up with beauty than to live for a long time. I do not agree with him, but at the same time I wish there was something I wanted as badly as he wanted to fry himself.
That portrait of Miriam Rothschild was by Sharon Carlton. You also heard Ron Falk, Alistair Duncan, Jane Harders and Michael Kayser. I'm Robin Williams. A programme from last century. Miriam died at 96 back in 2005. And so did Henry, the emu, who wanted to fly. He is now a book by Nedge.
One day, Henry jumped up and didn't come down. And he shouted, "Hey, look at me! I'm flying! I'm flying! I'm flying for real!" before he crashed into a massive gum tree. But nothing could stop Henry now that he'd started. His adventures in flight had begun. He was orbiting Earth and his wings could now take him anywhere under the sun. Henry coasted with seagulls out over oceans and flew across hot desert sands. From Australia to Iceland and Cuba to Rome, airborne to far distant lands. He sailed the cool trade winds that blew over islands and soared the hot updrafts on high, feeling the thrill of the orbit of Earth and the pleasure of being able to fly. Past huge jumbo planes and sleek Air Force jets, Henry gave pilots a fright. "What was that?" they asked, quickly checking their instruments, when an emu flashed briefly in sight. Before very long, crowds started to appear. Quickly, the word got around. Henry, the flying emu was coming! And crowds waved bright flags on the ground. "How did you do it?" a reporter asked Henry. "Become the first emu to fly!" Henry paused, looked out at the earth and the clouds, and gave a soft-spoken reply. "Catching your dreams isn't simple," Henry said. "But to get them quickly, you'll find that to take your first step to reach for the stars, first you must fly with your mind."
Henry the Emu is now a delightful book by Niraj Lal. And so we end this year, as we have for some decades, with a song by someone who's sadly no longer alive. Guess who?
"We three kings of Orient are, one on a tractor, two in a car, one on a scooter, tooting a hooter, following yonder star, oh
star of wonder, star of light, star of beauty, she'll be right, star of glory, that's the story, following yonder star."
Yes, a science show tradition, finishing with dear late John Clark, also known as Fred Dagg, and there's a film about his life just out. And Henry the Flying Emu is always worth hearing again, as he, along with Dagg and Miriam Rothschild, insisted that great work, great discoveries, first need your own firm hope of progress. And in that spirit, next week, I'll introduce another Science Show host to lift your spirits in this new year. Production by David Fisher. I'm Robin Williams.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.